Hey everyone, Sarah here. I wanted to let you know that we here at NYG, like so many of you, are horrified at the abuse the US government is inflicting on kids and families at our border. So we've decided to donate proceeds from today's show to organizations that are helping. We've just sent money to RACES, the largest immigration legal services provider in Texas, and to Act Blue, which is distributing funds to 12 organizations serving migrants, refugees, and detainees. We'll share the links in the show notes, and we hope you'll join us in helping however you can. Enjoy the show today.
Shopify builds software to help anyone with a great idea build a successful business. In fact, more than 50% of the entrepreneurs who use Shopify are women, including me. I use Shopify to power a bookapart.com, and so do people in 175 different countries. Now Shopify needs more great people to join their team. Visit shopify.com/careers to see open positions, learn about their culture, and so much more.
Welcome to Know You Go, the show about being ambitious and sticking together. I'm Jen Lucas.
I'm Katel Ledoux.
And I'm Sarah Wachter-Betcher. And we did it, everyone. What? We did it.
What?
We got Jen's dream guest on the show.
Is it Kesha?
Okay, we got Jen's second dream guest on the show. That would be Lily Chin, who's the 2017 College Jeopardy winner and a current graduate student at MIT. We talk with Lily about what it was like to be on the show, how her final Jeopardy answer made internet history, and how the whole experience changed the way that she looks at things like networked culture and online visibility.
Something that really got my attention in Lily's interview, I'm really wondering if we could start there for a second. If you subscribe to our newsletter, I wrote a letter to introduce issue 4, and I talked about how I used to get really bad panic attacks, and I still struggle with a lot of anxiety, and I've, you know, done a lot to sort of figure that out, and still an ongoing process. And while I felt really grateful to have a platform to share something really personal like that, I also felt really exposed. And I don't know, it made me think that I kind of forget that, you know, we're in a room talking to each other and it feels really safe and supportive. And we've had such good feedback about the show, which is great. But I don't know, you kind of forget that you're really putting yourself out there.
Yeah, I think about this a lot because I think podcasts do feel intimate and they feel intimate for the listener too. But you don't really know who might be listening. And I think with something like a newsletter, you don't know where that might end up or where it might get screenshotted and shared around. And I think, you know, we're gonna talk with Lily a little bit more about this, but there's ways in which that kind of hyper visibility or constant networked feeling online can make it hard to know sort of what context you're in, and the context shifts on you sometimes without you realizing it.
Totally. I mean, even writing that letter for that issue, I was like, okay, this went out to 100 some odd people. Thank you for subscribing. But it lives in forever in the internet, and anyone can find it. And I had these moments the day after we sent it out where I was like, okay, it's just it's out there. And I think, I don't know, that's a weird feeling.
What was making you feel vulnerable or exposed about it? Or what is the fear that you have about this letter existing out there where you talked about anxiety?
I mean, I think part of the anxiety that I talk about is the sort of spiral that happens where you start to feel small or weak, or you're not, up to snuff, or you're not performing, or you're just not the person that you're supposed to be. And I think that just is compounded when there's eyes on that, when people are looking at it and you're offering it up. And I think ultimately, I feel, like I said, very grateful. And I've said this, I think, to you, if not, recorded, I'm really proud of the therapy work that I've done. And I'm so, so happy that I get to share that. But it's also weird and raw. And so, yeah, I don't know, that this whole thing has been a process a little bit.
Yeah, it's never just one feeling. It's not oh, okay, I know I'm going to feel exposed, so I don't want to do it. Because there's things that make you want to share all of this, with people too. The internet is not something I don't know what's going to happen, so I'm out of here. Yeah. It's very much not one-sided.
Yeah. I think some people probably have that feeling. Like, I don't know what's going to happen, so I'm out of here. But clearly we don't, because we keep doing this podcast. And so we're like, we have things we want to talk about and things that, like, it's not just about, like, I want to talk about this, or even I want other people to, like, listen to me. Although, you know, I mean, I do want everybody in the world to listen to me. I got a lot of opinions. But that I think that the kinds of stuff that we're talking about and sometimes struggling with are things that, like, are really normal and that are, like, under discussed. And just the act of having natural conversations about them in a shared space is really powerful.
Yeah.
But also there is risk there. And I think that that's one of the things that we have to kind of, like, constantly make peace with, or at least I feel that like I have to make peace with what kinds of risks those might be. And so, you know, we've talked about this in the past, right? It's like, if I tweet that, what kind of randos are going to come troll me? Absolutely. And is it just going to be your, like, everyday rando that I can block? Or is it going to be actually something more sinister?
Yeah.
And, like, those are real, like, internal monologues that I'm having on a regular basis. At the same time, though, there's something to me that's a little different about both, like, podcasting and also something like a newsletter, or, like, I subscribe to a lot of people's tiny letters, that is a little bit more intimate feeling. And in some ways almost feels like there's been a resurgence in that. And, like, I look at it as almost like a way to reclaim space or reclaim something that's not exactly privacy, but that it feels a little bit more private in a world where so much of our communication feels so, like, actually, as Lily talked about it, like, hyper-networked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or, like, just branded. And that can feel weird too. I mean, I love that some of my friends have tiny newsletters, because I feel like I'm reading their journals, which is such a cool, it's such a cool feeling, you know?
It's got that same feeling of, like, you know, blogging back in the day, right, where, like, right, you know, it felt just more like, I don't know, more connected with the people. And I think that's sort of, like, what's nice about the podcast too, and getting feedback about the podcast, is I just feel like it's a different way to be connected with people.
Blogging has certainly changed a lot. And, you know, now it's like, what's the difference between a blog and, like, an online publication? What is Medium? Like, everything is sort of collapsed into, like, one big text box on the internet. And some of these spaces that we're talking about, like, give it a little bit of definition. You know, I think the same thing about a lot of the, like, private kind of back channel Slack accounts I'm in. I'm in a few of them that are, like, professionally focused, kind of, but what they really are is, like, private communities of people who I'm close to for one reason or another, where we can talk really openly and honestly about things that are happening in our professional world, but in a space where we, like, have absolute trust with people. And I find that to be really valuable. And I feel like that's where I turn so often to process how I'm feeling about things that are happening in the world, where, like, that used to be Twitter. And that doesn't always feel safe enough. Or sometimes it's not even about safety. It's like, sometimes that just feels too loud.
Yeah. Well, my therapist says that what we're doing is a gift. So I just want to share that with you.
Oh my God. If anybody listening has not listened to the episode where we interviewed Cattell's therapist, it is so good. Talk about a gift. Like, that was a gift.
That was really wonderful.
And if anyone listening has not subscribed to our newsletter yet, you definitely should, because it's full of more little gifts.
If you aren't subscribing to our newsletter, we started it about a month ago and we are doing it every other week. We have, like, super intimate letters from us about things happening in our lives, plus a whole bunch of links and things that we love. And it is called, maybe fittingly, I Love That. So if you go to knowyougoshow.com/I Love That, you can subscribe and you can also check out the back issues. Before we get to our interview with Lily, we've got a couple awesome folks to tell you about. The first is Harvest. Harvest makes software to help you track your time, manage your projects, and get paid. It's super easy to use on the web or via the app, and it's made my work life way easier over the years. I've seriously been a customer since 2011. I can barely remember 2011. Harvest does all kinds of stuff, including integrate with other tools you love like Basecamp, Slack, and Trello. You can also send and manage invoices right from your Harvest account and even take online payments. Try it for free at getharvest.com and get 50% off your first paid month with the code KNOWYOUGO. That's getharvest.com. Offer code KNOWYOUGO.
We'd also like to take a moment and thank our friends at WordPress. WordPress has been a supporter of NYG since the start, and we're big fans of theirs too. After all, it's how we run our website, knowyougoshow.com. We trust WordPress because it's super easy to set up and customize, but it's also really powerful. For example, we added plugins to host our podcast and also gather signups for our newsletter. You can even set up a buy button or add an online store. Plans start at just $4 a month, so what are you waiting for? Start building your website today. Go to wordpress.com/knowyougo for 15% off any new plan purchase. That's wordpress.com/knowyougo for 15% off your brand new website.
Lily Chen is a graduate student at MIT working towards a PhD in electrical engineering and computer science. Her technical research interests are in robotics hardware design. She studies how old and new forms of media collide, chiefly in video games, film, and internet culture. You might recognize her name, as Lily was also the 2017 College Jeopardy tournament champion, and she even created a meme while doing so. Welcome to Know You Go, Lily.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So we're super excited that you're here. We're big fans of Jeopardy, both at my house and at work. I have to tell you that we followed the college tournament really intently, and we were definitely all rooting for you when you were on.
Oh, thanks.
We had this joke that I was going to miss who won because the final day of the tournament was also actually my son's due date.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Yeah. And sure enough, I went into labor that morning. At one point during labor, I think I definitely said to my husband and doula, I wonder who won College Jeopardy. We were very stoked the next week to find out that it was you.
Oh, thanks.
So what got you interested in being on Jeopardy?
The RA for my dorm, actually, he had been on Jeopardy the summer before, and we had all like made viewing parties and gone to see him. So when it came time for the test to be taken, he was like, yeah, y'all should just take it and see how you do. So it actually took me a couple of tries before I was on the show. But then, my second time I tried out, I got on. So
nice. That's awesome. What's the audition process like?
So it's pretty cool. The first round is just this online test, and it's just really quick fire, just asking you trivia questions. And if you do well enough on that, they invite you to an audition, which is in person. And the producers themselves definitely have a ton of energy because at the end of the day, Jeopardy is a TV show. So they want to make sure that you're really excited, that you have some sort of stage presence, and that like, you know, you're actually the person who took the exam since it's all online.
Yes. Yeah. Were you nervous going into that?
I was very nervous the first time, but the second time I actually was thinking like, oh, like I have to go all the way to New York. It's kind of a pain. And I wasn't even sure if I wanted to go, but I had a lot of fun. So I ended up just going. And I think being more relaxed the second time around helped me out, like be more natural in front of the camera.
When do you find out right away if you're going to be on?
Oh, no. So for the tournament, you actually have to wait for like a month or so. I had forgotten actually when I got the call that I was going to be on. And for adult Jeopardy, you actually have to wait. You're in the contestant pool for like a year and a half before, like, so you're just waiting there.
Wow.
Yeah.
So when you found out and then you went to the show, what was the energy like on set there?
That's really interesting because it's like you have 15 people, like they definitely don't know each other, just sort of randomly in this place. And the thing I was struck by was that the set was actually quite large, right? Like you're so used to seeing it on the TV, just like cutting from the clues to the contestants and back again. But like actually seeing it as a space that you inhabit, it was really interesting. I guess also the energy is just the same thing of like, oh, I understand like all of these contestant producers are really trying to hype you up and have you really excited. And so like at the end of the first day, I just immediately went to bed. I didn't even have dinner or anything, just like conked out because I was so exhausted from being that high energy. Yeah. The next couple of times I went on the show, actually, it was a lot more comfortable because I knew how sort of the filming schedule works, but it's a very tiring experience.
How did you prepare for being on the show?
So I did trivia in high school, so like Quiz Bowl and those things. So I had most of my trivia knowledge from there. But I would say like the 1 month before the show, it was like learning about betting strategy, reading up of what the common questions are. I don't think I did as much preparation as other people did, but definitely looking into betting strategy was a big one.
I feel like it's such a wide variety, like you never really know. I mean, there's like some repeats I feel like on Jeopardy all the time in like topics, but it's like, how could you possibly narrow it all down?
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny thing, right? Because it's still a TV show. So you need to have the answers be like things that people at home will be like, oh, I've heard of this before. So you can't have it too obscure. I remember one thing funny, though, is that the popular culture is definitely like right? Like I'm a 2000s kid. And then, so I think one of the things was like 80s and 90s TV shows. And I was like, well, I'm not going to do well.
Yeah. I know. I think my coworkers and I always watch that. And that's like definitely our alley. Yeah. So we mentioned a bit in the intro that you are also the creator of a meme, which happened during Final Jeopardy. Can you tell us that story?
So I had seen like people give funny Final Jeopardy answers in the past. So I decided beforehand that, oh, if I ever have a chance to do a lock game, like a game where I would win no matter what, I would put some funny answers down. And I decided to do dank memes. But then I was like, oh, that's probably not PG enough for Jeopardy. So I decided spicy memes. And then on the Final Jeopardy thing, it turned out it was a who is question. So then I said, who is the spiciest meme lord? And got Alex Trebek to say it on national television.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
So it was not planned.
I knew that like if I had the chance, I definitely wanted to say it. But it was also not planned for how viral of a reaction was gotten. Like it turned out, I was just thinking about my friends. They were like, oh, we watch memes all the time at home. Like they'll like it. And then it turned out like the internet also really likes memes. So I did not plan for that at all. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. How has that been?
So I've been actually thinking about writing more academically about this experience, but this idea of this sudden burst of fame, like I was on the front page of Reddit twice. There's like a million views on that video. And then it's suddenly a spike and then this long tail of just, there's still this ambient fame, especially since I'm still at MIT for graduate school where people, especially other students will recognize me. But, you know, just the other day I was in the North End and got recognized on the street and it's not something I'm expecting. And this idea of like, you know, this sudden burst of fame, like going up and then going down again. And then suddenly like, oh, reruns are happening. I'm getting a lot more Facebook messages from randos. It's sort of interesting. And it's also interesting to be known more for Jeopardy than for my research, which is something I'm more excited about, I guess. But at the same time, like the fame that I've gotten from Jeopardy might have helped me in terms of like recognition for my own research, right? Like whenever my advisor introduces me to someone else from a different lab, they're like, she's like, oh, do you know that this is the Jeopardy winner? So that's an interesting balance. Yeah.
You've even taught a class about this, right, at MIT?
Yeah. So there's a educational studies program where MIT undergrads and grad students can teach high school and middle school students. And so this is related with the comparative media studies part, where I really enjoy sort of showing that like it's not just like analyzing books or film, like you can actually do all of these cool analysis of contemporary media culture. So that's what I was trying to do, was take my current case example and being like, look, like here's how these media analysis techniques can really help you understand what's going on in your life, even if it's something as weird as like national television.
I mean, have your views changed a lot about what it's like to be a public figure?
Yeah, I think I'm more confused. I get more and more confused about why people want to be famous. Like when I'm doing my Twitch streaming, I think it's interesting that there's always like these people who are like, oh, I want to make it big. There's some crazy statistic about 1 in 3 British children want to be a YouTube star when they grow up.
Oh.
Yeah, it's because, I mean, that's what you're growing up with and that's what you're seeing as your content. It's not like TVs or movies as much anymore. It's like, oh, I see these kids like making videos on YouTube. And I'm sort of like wondering why people want the fame, because like, I kind of get it, right? Like I want my research to have exposure because then more people are like thinking about my ideas. And I think I really appreciate that. But then at the same time, it's like, there's so much attention to your life. Also like the harassment part of it. And it's a weird public-private divide that I'm not sure people know fully what they're getting into when they sign up for this. And some people enjoy being like a figure of controversy, right? Like Kanye West and Donald Trump come to mind, where it doesn't matter what the press is, but as long as people are talking about you, sort of continues like some gratification.
Right. I mean, you talked about being on the front page of Reddit, and there's also a Jeopardy community subreddit. And how does it feel to like look at people talking about you?
I was worried at first that there was going to be about the internet hate. And there's a Women of Jeopardy Facebook group where people sort of like commiserate about the experience. Yeah, there's a really good Vice article that's called like Big Tits for 600. And it's just sort of like a very good compilation and just sort of talking about the experience of being a woman on national television and sort of what that means. So I was a little bit nervous about that because I had read these stories before. But when I came down to it and I saw what people were writing, it just sort of seemed so petty that people were coming up with these impressions of me after 20 minutes of national television. I was actually more taken aback the second time I went around for the Tournament of Champions, where people were actually extremely nice and just sort of doing analysis of the game and less about me, because I had braced myself for all of this verbal abuse. And then when it wasn't there and people were just really kind, it's like, oh, she tried really hard. It was really not what I expected and sort of threw me off guard.
For those who don't know, on Reddit, you can, like, you have like a little identifier that like says that like you were a contestant on the show to like prove that it's you. And I've seen like a couple of people definitely get into the threads with other people and reply to some of it. And I feel like a lot of it is positive. But then, you know, as you mentioned, like with women, I'll see a lot of comments like, oh, her, like not about you, but about like other contestants. I'll be like, oh, I hated her. Her voice was so annoying. Mm-hmm. And it's like, wow. People are harsh.
Yeah, it's just also like in some sense of being like a female figure, like in the spotlight, it sort of puts you up. Like we're so used to like thinking about women as like in terms of their outward appearance that even when it's on a very academic game like Jeopardy, like people are still defaulting to thinking it as like an object of attraction or something.
You've talked about, you know, you have an interest in the fight to maintain one's identity and narrative in a hyper-mediated network culture. Mm-hmm. Can you describe a bit what that means?
What I found really is that usually you have some control over your own identity. It's very closely tied to you. Obviously, you can't control everything about what people think about you, but, you know, you talk to people, it forms an identity. But what happened is that with Jeopardy, there was this very immediate division of between myself and my image, right? So like millions of people saw me saying, who is the spiciest meme lord on national television? And so some people are trying to co-opt this as like, oh, look, it's a meme culture. And then other people like Jeopardy itself is trying to co-opt this and saying like, we need to target the 18 to 35 age demographic for advertisements. And this is like, you know, a cool kid. So they kind of go over and it's like, how do you do, fellow kids? And my friends from high school one day were like, why are you on my Instagram feed? And I was like, what? And it turns out that they had used my image to advertise on Instagram to try to encourage more people to apply for the college test, which I think is crazy. Like, sure, yeah, I signed off all my rights. But in some sense, right, like their curation of my image is no longer outside my control. Mm-hmm. I'm like fighting against, you know, Jeopardy. I'm fighting against 4chan. I'm fighting against all of these forces about who gets to control my image. So it becomes an interesting thing, because I think this happens on some level to everybody, right? There was a good article talking about how Snapchat is dying, and this idea that even on Facebook, even on Twitter, all of these things, we're cultivating our own personal brand of how we want to come up with, that everything is now sort of a online interactive CV, and there's not really any chance for you to be yourself because you're worried about how it's going to be taken either way. So not everyone has this experience of like suddenly national television is taking my image and running with it, but we're always sort of trying to deal with this idea that now that everything's on the internet, there are so many different forces that you're really trying to curate something. And is it even possible anymore?
Do you think it's possible?
I think in some sense you have to accept that like you no longer have control of your image, which is kind of like what I'm doing. But at the same time, so this is coming from a book I read from John Ronson, like, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. It's this idea where individual people have to sort of be their own PR firm, that like you have to, like this brand curation. I think it is possible, but it becomes a lot more effort and you sort of have to understand what you're doing, right? There's a lot of talk about the right to be forgotten because it's like, oh, kids don't understand what they're doing and you might say something dumb on the internet. I don't think we ever had the right to be forgotten, like within your community. It's the classic, like, you know, small town, scarlet letter, everybody knows what you did wrong. But I think encouraging more people to understand how these forces happen and how to better protect yourself, I think that's sort of the best you can do.
I do a lot of public speaking in the web field, and I'll remember like the first time that I got back from a conference and their conference had posted pictures of me. And of course I'm like in mid-word. So like my face is like all distorted and it's just like, I'm like, oh my God, that's awful. But I was like, hey, I guess I made it. Like, and I remember now, cause I have like, you know, people will be like, hey, can you take a picture? And then they'll like, you'll take a picture of them and they'll want to see the picture to like, see if it's okay.
Yeah.
And like,
that doesn't happen to me anymore. Like, I've just given up on that battle, right? Because I think there's so many bad pictures of me on the internet. But I did a talk one time for a girl development group here, which was like sort of trying to encourage more people to get into public speaking. And it was just sort of like, you know, what's the worst that could happen? And I went through and showed like highlights of all the terrible pictures of me on the internet. And it just sort of was like one of those, well, like, really, what is the worst case scenario of this? And like, sort of, is it that bad in protecting yourself, like maybe against the things that are really bad and not things like, oh, here's an unflattering image of me.
For public speaking, like, you go out there and you know really clearly that, oh, I'm going to put out a face and I'm going to present myself. And so I should like prepare myself for, you know, being like judged by other people. But now with the internet, it's less clear that really like anything that you do, like it could be subject to like people seeing it and people making judgments of it. There was a famous case, which is Justine Sacco, who made a tweet that was like, oh, I'm going to Africa to hope I don't get AIDS. Just kidding. I'm white. Yeah. And then
before she like got on a plane, right? And then she got off the plane and there was like an obvious amount of backlash. Yeah.
And but what's the thing was, is that she only had like 200 followers before that. And so she probably thought like, oh, I'm just going to make this like off color joke to like my 200 friends. And then so what she thought was a private transaction actually blew up into like a huge, like, you know, trending on Twitter, like number one thing. And I think that's really the idea that I'm trying to get at, is that it's less clear what your private and public actions should be. So you sort of overprotectively like try to curate everything. And then you sort of, like you were saying about the pictures, it's almost impossible to do that.
Right. So you know all this, like, you know all of the potential for like repercussions of being on the internet and what can happen. But that said, like, you are still like, I think, sort of embracing this public figure. So as you mentioned before, you have a Twitch stream, right?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit more about that. Like, what makes you stream and what sort of things are you streaming?
So I stream on Twitch, and Twitch is primarily for video games. And so I started streaming because, one, I had the Jeopardy fame and I was like, oh, this would be a good platform to jump off on. And two, a lot of my friends stream speedruns, which are trying to play video games super fast. And I was like, oh, as a media scholar, I don't understand why they do it. So the easiest way to learn would be to do it myself. Mm-hmm. And it started off from this academic interest, and then it turned into, I really appreciate the community. There are a couple people from Scandinavia who like tune into me like super regularly, even though it's like 3 a.m. in the Sweden time. And I find myself that like I'm putting on this like show for them, that I enjoy talking to them. I enjoy, like, you know, discussing the video games or like what's going on in my life. And that's sort of an interesting feeling. Like it's gone beyond just like, oh, I want to put my ideas out there, and I want to talk to these like two or three people, and then I make more friends, and it's quite nice.
It's again that balance, right? Like, here's a potentially like field that we're like opening ourselves up to all this like potential negativity, but you keep finding like really positive things.
Because in some sense, the reason why it is still a positive experience is because I have like, you know, 10 people watch me regularly on a twice a week basis, right? And similarly, I have sort of private, I guess, IRC, you know, like internet chat channels that I do with my friends. And in some sense, like, the only reason that these are still nice is because they're public, but they're still private in a way. And sort of finding these spaces on like an increasingly networked culture is difficult. Before, in the past, it used to be that you would be in these local communities, right? Like, oh, I live in the Cambridge area, so I'll like talk to all the people in Cambridge and find similar things. But now, in some sense, we're creating local communities, but on the internet. So it's no longer local geographically, but it's local in terms of interests or maybe like respect for each other and things like that.
Like you were saying, you know, you just jumped into streaming because you wanted to learn more about it, which is just so neat. Like, to just like, okay, I've got an interest in something, I'm just going to do it. Is that generally how you live your life?
Yeah, I definitely do things because like, oh, it'll be a lot of fun, or like, it'll be a good story out of it. The whole thing about doing the spiciest meme lord was definitely like, I'll get a good story out of this, or like, you know, even trying out for Jeopardy in the first place.
I think that's like such a neat idea. You know, I was reading a bit on your Reddit AMA, you had said, one of my guiding principles for whether I'm wavering between whether or not I should do something is, will I get a good story out of it?
Yeah, exactly.
This year, the College Jeopardy tournament of 2018 just happened. Mm-hmm. And you also offered advice to the folks taking part in it. And you've also been an MIT Women in Electrical Engineering and Computer Science mentor and worked with Girls Who Code. You are a mentor extraordinaire.
Oh, I don't know. It's just like, I have advice and like, I appreciate all the people who gave me advice. So like, if it makes sense to just sort of give back as I can. Yeah. I don't know. I thought it was interesting because recently someone came up to me and was like, hey, do you want to be part of my admissions consulting group where like, you know, parents pay a lot of money and you like review essays and stuff like that. And it just felt really bad. Like, cause on one level, right? Like I enjoy doing this work and like, it would be nice to get paid for it. But on the other hand, it felt like contributing to these systems of like people not getting the mentorship that they need just because they don't have the right networks or they don't have a ton of cash. And it feels like that the right thing to do is to give back in like whatever ways you can. Like oftentimes I feel like I'm not giving as much as I could. I was a medlink in the dorm system, which basically like we're students and we live in the dorm and we have basic first aid training. And we also know about all of the medical resources on campus. So if people are having like relationship troubles, we can point them to mental health or, you know, if they got a cut, we have Band-Aids and things. And I think that was one of like most rewarding experiences because, right, it's not just that, oh, like I want to help people because like it boosts the resume or something like that. It's just that people are having trouble and you want to help them out how you can. I feel like I could do more for mentorship, like because like as you're saying, like I'm doing a lot of different things. But at the same time, I feel like being there and at least like reminding people that there is somebody who cares is important.
Right. It's really neat. So, I mean, you find it rewarding, I'm assuming.
Yeah. Like I said, I have a sort of insecurities about, am I actually doing enough to help people? Because when you're doing so many things, like, is it on a superficial level or not? That's why I was a little like taken aback when you were like, oh, you're a mentor extraordinaire. Because on some level, right, it's just giving advice to people because you've been through these experiences and, you know, they haven't. Even the older grad students, when I'm freaking out about things and they're just being like, yeah, I freaked out about this too. It's sort of comforting.
So what's next? What has you super excited?
I'm really excited about my research, especially now that it's summertime, because I don't have sort of going from undergrad to grad school is this transition away from other people are setting the curriculum and like telling you what to learn to I'm setting my own path and like my own research. So I'm working soft robotics. So usually when you think of a robot, it's this hard metal skeleton, but soft robots saying, hey, what if we make robots out of rubber or silicone, like soft materials so that they're safer around people and they can pick up squishy things. So I've been working on how do we make these soft robots work? How do they grab things? I'm also really excited about sort of this Jeopardy paper that I'm doing. How do we think about fame and identity, using myself as a case study, but sort of broadening it to other people? And then finally, I guess the combination of these two interests is as robots are becoming more and more commonplace, as algorithms and big data are sort of changing the way we approach things, how can we have people still be like comfortable with this, with these new algorithms and things? Like, it's more than just like, if I have the robot from the Jetsons show up, like, can I interact with it? It's more of on a fundamental level of when I say AI, most people don't know what this means. And it's actually pretty understandable, but we need to stop thinking about scientists as like, you know, these like mad scientists who are doing whatever they want in their lab coats and more of something approachable, especially as the future is heading towards that direction.
We've talked a little bit before with one of our previous guests, Allison, about this idea of what the scientist, the white man in a white lab coat, the crazy hair. And I think like generally, you know, you start talking about robots and generally there's like the either like I am like intimidated by that subject or like Skynet questions, I think, starts getting thrown out.
Yeah, I think especially for my research, right? So soft robotics, it's intentionally for like, you know, being around humans instead of not being in a factory somewhere. And I remember there was a conversation about like, what does the future of work look like? And they're like, oh, you know, service jobs will be okay because who wants a robot to take care of grandma? And I was like raising my hand. I was like, actually, this is literally my research. And so on some level, like I really want to tell people the thinking behind it of like what the direction, because I can't predict the future of what research is going to be like, but to reduce the fear of like, what does AI mean? What does deep learning mean? I think would help people understand like, okay, like one, this is a future that I can understand. And two, this is a future where I can actually belong in.
So what are you telling people?
So one thing that I need to keep remembering is that when I am not in MIT and everyone's working on like robots and drones and what have you, that like, most people, when they hear robots, are like, whoa, like you must be really smart. And I'm like, wait, no, I'm not. I'm not that smart. It's just like, you know, like, you know how to build things. You know how to build things with Legos and stuff like that. And when people hear algorithms, they think of like ones and zeros flying everywhere. But at the end of the day, an algorithm is just like a set of instructions. You know, when you follow a recipe, you're already following an algorithm of some sort. So I think, like, you know, it's the same thing of like being able to talk about your experiences and sort of destigmatizing things, whether it's like, you know, math is hard or like algorithms are mysterious black boxes. I think just explaining things and, you know, being patient. I mean, I think that people are going to realize at some point that robots are just a tool, right? And that, like, you still need to remember that, like, tools are for humanity.
Lily, before you go, where will the next place be that we see you?
Oh, hopefully on like the cover of like the New York Times for some cool robot research.
Yes. Also, you're welcome back here anytime.
Definitely. Oh, thank you.
Please let us know how the soft robotics are going and how we can make sure to welcome our new audience.
All right.
So. Awesome. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah. Thanks for interviewing me.
So this week, I want to say fuck yeah to Pride Month, because June is Pride Month and that's awesome. It's also my birthday, just PS, just letting you know. And I don't know, this got me thinking about some of the folks that I follow on Instagram, and one of them is a brand called Wild Fang. And I really love them because they really walk the walk. They sort of say they're not just a brand, they're a band. And I love that because they're very focused on the people who buy their clothing, and they're very feminist, and they, like, you can see that in everything that they do, including the fact that they give a lot of money that they raise to charity. And this month, a percentage of their proceeds is going to the Trevor Project, which is the world's largest nonprofit organization focused on suicide prevention and crisis intervention among lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, and questioning youth, which is fucking amazing. So this just got me thinking, and we sort of started talking a little bit about who we're shopping and the brands that we're supporting. And I think it just led us to talking about, like, paying attention to that a little bit more.
Yeah. One of the things that I've really been noticing is just, it feels like there's a lot more options all of a sudden for brands that I can support that are doing things that are important to me, or that are offering products that are, like, just more inclusive and also just better suited to, like, me personally. And it seems like a big sea change that's happening just in the last couple of years. Like, for example, I know a lot of folks go absolutely wild for Everlane. And one of the things Everlane does, it's like they do luxury basics is their market. Luxury basics, like, reasonably priced or something. I don't think that's their actual tagline. And one of the things that they do is they tell you exactly how much of that money was spent on paying the garment workers, how much of it was spent on shipping, how much of it they get as profit. And so it's really clear exactly where that money is going. And I think that that is, you know, that's like one example of a way that they're kind of trying to set some new standards. I'm really excited to see organizations that are, like, making cool shit with a good cause in mind, making cool shit that is going to serve a wider range of people, just making cool shit while throwing away some of the, like, bad practices of retail industry.
Another place that I have bought a couple things from, which is, this is just like a fun clothing shop that does, like, t-shirts and sweatshirts. It's actually, I'm wearing this sweatshirt in my photo on the website, and it says smile, and it has, like, a possum, and it just has smile is crossed out, and it says nope, which I fucking love. It's like my favorite sweatshirt, and it's by a company called Culture Flock. And they are a company that, quoting them, believes in equality for all, being kind to others, and protecting the planet and having fun every day. And I love that because it's very simple. But they're also, we've talked about this on the show a couple times about, like, place, and that you can do really fucking cool things and, like, a lot of different places. And they're based in Springfield, Missouri, which I think is super cool.
I've also been trying to remember to shop local and trying to pick up things at, like, places nearby where I live, because just like people in Springfield, Missouri, there's places everywhere that have a lot of local great shops near there. So I've been trying to, like, remember to do that instead of doing my very easy and convenient ordering that I do sometimes. Sometimes I'll go down the street to get the baby shampoo that I need instead of ordering that and getting it in 5 days.
Totally. It also, like, feels really good when you can see the person who is either, you know, he either owns the shop where they've obviously done a lot of thinking about what they're stocking there, or, you know, they've even made it. It's very cool to buy something directly from that person.
Totally.
I just really like the way that we are having a lot more conversations, at least like in the circles that I'm in, and I think like in the circles that maybe a lot of our listeners are in, about sort of what we're buying and where it's from and why we're buying it. And it's not to say that I've stopped all like bad impulse buys when it comes to like t-shirts that I think I'm going to love and then I don't love or whatever. But it really has made me think a little bit more carefully about the way that I think about things like fashion, or the way that I think about like who and what I'm supporting. But yeah, I'm like really excited to see just a lot more options and a lot more stuff that I can feel better about and not just feel like I'm, you know, just spending money on fast fashion. So I guess I would say fuck yeah to having way more options when it comes to places we could shop locally, places we can shop online, and maybe an even bigger fuck yeah to the fact that now I know what to get Catel for her birthday, which is definitely going to come from Wild Thing.
Yes. Fuck yeah. That's it for this week's episode of Know You Go, the show about being ambitious and sticking together. NYG is recorded in our home city of Philadelphia and produced by Steph Colburn. Our theme music is by The Diaphone. Thanks to Lily Chin for being our guest today. If you like what you've been hearing, please make sure to subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to our newsletter. Your support helps us spread the word, and we love that. We'll be back next week with another great guest.